Side 3, Imperial Earth, beginning on page 105. The car was now passing over a slender bridge spanning a wide and rather dirty river. The spectacle of so much genuine water was impressive, but it looked very cold and dismal on this dreary night. The Potomac, said Washington, but wait until you see it on a sunny day, after that silt's gone downstream. Then it's blue and sparkling, and you'd never guess it took 200 years of hard work to get it that way. And that's Watergate, not the original, of course. That was pulled down around 2000, though the Democrats wanted to make it a national monument. And the Kennedy Center? That is the original, more or less. Every 50 years, some architect tries to salvage it, but now it's been given up as a bad job. So this was Washington, still basking, though not very effectively on a night like this, in its former glories. Duncan had read that the physical appearance of the city had changed very little in 300 years, and he could well believe it. Most of the old government and public buildings had been carefully preserved. The result, said the critics, was the largest inhabited museum in the world. A little later, the car turned into a driveway which led through beautifully kept lawns. There was a gentle beeping from the control panel, and a sign flashed beneath the steering handle, switched to manual. George Washington took over and proceeded at a cautious 20 clicks between flower beds and sculptured bushes, coming to a halt under the portico of an obviously very old building. It seemed much too large for a private house, but rather too small for a hotel, despite the fact that it bore the sign, in lettering so elaborate that it was almost impossible to read, Centennial Hotel. Professor Washington seemed to have an extraordinary knack of anticipating questions before they could be asked. It was built by a railroad baron in the late 19th century. He wanted to have somewhere to entertain Congress, and the investment paid him several thousand percent. We've taken it over for the occasion, and most of the official guests will be staying here. To Duncan's astonishment, and embarrassment since personal service was unknown on Titan, his scanty baggage was seized by two black gentlemen wearing gorgeous liveries. One of them addressed him in a soft, musical language of which he could not comprehend a single word. "You're overdoing it, Henry," George Washington remonstrated mildly. "That may be genuine slave patter, but what's the point if only you linguistic historians can understand it? And where did you get that makeup? I may need some myself." Despite this appeal, Duncan still found the reply unintelligible. On their way up in a gilded birdcage of a tiny elevator, Washington commented, "I'm afraid Professor Murchison is entering too thoroughly into the spirit of 76. Still, it shows we've made some progress. A couple of centuries ago, if you'd suggested to him that he'd play one of his humbler ancestors, even in a pageant, he'd have knocked your head off. Now he's having a perfectly wonderful time, and we may not be able to get him back to his classes at Georgetown." Washington looked at his plump brown hand and sighed. "It's getting more and more difficult to find a genuine black skin. I'm no race snob," he added hastily, "but it will be a pity when we're all the same shade of off-white. Meanwhile, I suppose you do have a slightly unfair advantage." Duncan looked at him for a moment with puzzled incomprehension. He had never given any more thought to his skin color than to that of his hair. Indeed, if suddenly challenged, he would have been hard-pressed to describe either. Certainly he had never thought of himself as black, but now he realized with understandable satisfaction that he was several shades darker than George Washington, descendant of African kings. When the door of the hotel suite closed behind him, and it was no longer necessary to keep up appearances, Duncan collapsed thankfully into one of the heavily padded chairs. It tilted backward so voluptuously that he guessed it had been especially designed for visitors from low-gravity worlds. George Washington was certainly an admirable host and seemed to have thought of everything. Nevertheless, Duncan knew that it would be a long time before he felt really at ease. Quite apart from the drag of gravity, there were dozens of subtle reminders that he was not on his home world. One was the very size of the room. By Titanian standards, it was enormous. And it was furnished in such luxury as he had never seen in real life, but only in historical plays. Yet that, of course, was completely appropriate. He was living in the middle of history. This mansion had been built before the first man had ventured beyond the atmosphere, and he guessed that most of its fittings were contemporary. The cabinets full of delicate glassware, the oil paintings, the quaint old photographs of stiffly posed and long-forgotten eminences, perhaps the original Washington? No, cameras hadn't been invented then. The heavy drapes? None of these could have been matched on Titan, and Duncan doubted if their holographic patterns were even stored in the central library. The very communications console looked as if it dated back to the last century. Although all the elements were familiar, the blank gray screen, the alphanumeric keyboard, the camera lens and speaker grill, something about the design gave it an old-fashioned appearance. When he felt that he could again walk a few yards without danger of collapse, Duncan made his way cautiously to the console and parked himself heavily on the chair in front of it. The type and serial numbers were in the usual place, tucked away at the side of the screen. Yes, there was the date, 2183. It was almost 100 years old. Yet apart from a slight fuzziness of the E and A on the contact pads, there was practically no sign of wear. And why should there be, in a piece of equipment that did not contain a single moving part? This was another sharp reminder that Earth was an old world and had learned to conserve the past. Novelty, for its own sake, was an unlamented relic of the centuries of waste. If a piece of equipment functioned satisfactorily, it was not replaced merely because of changes in style, but only if it broke down or there was some fundamental improvement in performance. The home communications console, or COMSOL, had reached its technological plateau in the early 21st century, and Duncan was prepared to bet that there were units on Earth that had given continuous service for over 200 years. And that was not even one-tenth of the history of this world. For the first time in his life, Duncan felt an almost overwhelming sense of inferiority. He had not really believed that the Terrans would regard him as a barbarian from the outer darkness, but now he was not so sure. Chapter 18, Embassy. Duncan's Minisec had been a parting gift from Cullen, and he was not completely familiar with its controls. There had been nothing really wrong with his old unit, and he had left it behind with some regret, but the casing had become stained and battle-scarred, and he had to agree that it was not elegant enough for Earth. The sec was the standard size of all such units, determined by what could fit comfortably in the normal human hand. At a quick glance, it did not differ greatly from one of the small electronic calculators that had started coming into general use in the late 20th century. It was, however, infinitely more versatile, and Duncan could not imagine how life would be possible without it. Because of the finite size of clumsy human fingers, it had no more controls than its ancestors of 3 centuries earlier. There were 50 neat little studs. Each, however, had a virtually unlimited number of functions according to the mode of operation, for the character visible on each stud changed according to the mode. Thus, on alphanumeric, 26 of the studs bore the letters of the alphabet, while 10 showed the digits 0 to 9. On math, the letters disappeared from the alphabetical studs and were replaced by multiplication, addition, division, subtraction, and equal signs, and all the standard mathematical functions. Another mode was dictionary. The sec stored over 100,000 words whose 3-line definitions could be displayed on the bright little screen, steadily rolling over page by page if desired. Clock and calendar also used this screen for display, but for dealing with vast amounts of information, it was desirable to link the sec to the much larger screen of a standard console. This could be done through the unit's optical interface, a tiny transmit-receive bullseye operating in the near ultraviolet. As long as this lens was in visual range of the corresponding sensor on a console, the two units could happily exchange information at the rate of megabits per second. Thus, when the sec's own internal memory was saturated, its contents could be dumped into a larger store for permanent keeping. Or conversely, it could be loaded up through the optical link with any special data required for a particular job. Duncan was now employing it for its simplest possible use, merely as a speech recorder, which was almost an insult to a machine of such power. But first, there was an important matter to settle, the question of security. An easily remembered word, preferably one that would never be employed in this context, would be the simplest key. Better still, a word that did not even exist. Then it could never accidentally trigger the sex memory. Suddenly he had it. There was one name he would never forget. And if he deliberately misspelled it, he carefully pecked out Kalindi, followed by the sequence of instructions that would set up the memory. Then he unplugged the tiny radio mic, pinned it on his shirt, spoke a test message, and checked that the machine would play it back only after it had been given the correct order. Duncan had never kept a diary, but he had decided to do so as soon as he arrived on Earth. In a few weeks, he would meet more people and visit more places than in the whole of his preceding life, and would certainly have experiences that could never be repeated when he returned to Titan. He was determined to miss nothing that could be helped, for the memories he was storing now would be of inestimable value in the years ahead. How many times in his old age, he wondered, would he play back these words of his youth? 2276, June 12. I'm still adapting to Earth's gravity, and don't think I'll ever get really used to it. But I can stand for an hour at a time now, without developing too many aches and pains. Yesterday, I saw a man actually jumping. I could hardly believe my eyes. George, who thinks of everything, has arranged a masseur for me. I don't know if that's helped at all, but it's certainly an interesting experience. Duncan stopped recording and contemplated this slight understatement. Such luxuries were rare on Titan, and he had never before had a massage in his life. Bernie Patras, the amiable and uninhibited young man who had visited him, had shown a remarkable, indeed startling, knowledge of physiology, and had also given Duncan much useful advice. He was a specialist in treating off-worlders, and recommended one sovereign cure for gravitational complaints. Spend an hour a day floating in a bath, at least for the first month. Don't let your schedule squeeze this out, no matter how busy you are. If you have to, you can do a lot of work in a tub, reading, dictating, and so forth. Why, the lunar ambassador used to hold briefings with just his nose and mouth above water. Said he could think better that way. That would certainly be an undiplomatic spectacle, Duncan told himself. Unique even in this city, which had probably seen everything. I've been here 3 days now, and this is the first time I've had the energy and the inclination and the opportunity to put my thoughts in order. But from now on, I swear I'll do this every day. The first morning after my arrival, General George, that's what everyone calls him, took me to the embassy, which is only a few hundred meters from the hotel. Ambassador Robert Farrell apologized because he couldn't come to the spaceport. He said, I knew you'd be in good hands with George. He's the world's greatest organizer. Then the general left us, and we had a long private talk. I met Bob Farrell on his last visit to Titan 3 years ago, and he remembers me well. At least he gave that impression, which I suppose is an art all diplomats have to acquire. He was very helpful and friendly, but I got the feeling that he was sounding me out and not telling me everything he knew. I realized that he's in an ambiguous position, being a Terran yet having to represent our interests. One day this may cause difficulties, but I don't know what we can do about it, since no native-born Titanian can ever live on Earth. Luckily, there are no urgent problems, as the hydrogen agreement isn't due for renegotiation until 80. But there were dozens of little items on my shopping list, and I left him with plenty to think about, such as why can't we get quicker deliveries of equipment? Can anything be done to improve shipping schedules? What went wrong with the new student exchange? And similar galaxy-shaking questions. He promised a set of appointments for me with all the people who could straighten these things out, but I tried to hint that I wanted to spend some time looking at Earth. And after all, he's not only our man in Washington, but also our representative on Terra. He seemed quite surprised when I told him that I expected to stay on Earth for almost a year. But at this stage, I thought it best not to give him the main reason. I'm sure he'll guess it quickly enough. When he tactfully asked about my budget, I explained that the Centennial Committee had been a great help, and there was still some Mackenzie money in the World Bank, which I was determined to use. I understand, he said, old Malcolm's over 120 now, isn't he? Even on Earth, leaving as little as possible for the community fund to grab is a popular pastime. Then he added, not very hopefully, that any personal balances could be legally bequeathed to the embassy for its running expenses. I said that was a very interesting point, and I bear it in mind. He volunteered to give me any assistance on my speech, which was kind of him. When I said I was still working on it, he reminded me that it was essential to have a final draft by the end of June, so that all the important commentators could study it in advance. Otherwise, it would be drowned in the flood of verbiage on July 4th. That was a very good point, which I hadn't thought of. But then I said, won't the other speakers do exactly the same? And he answered, of course, but I've got good friends in all the media, and there's a great interest in Titan. You're still intrepid pioneers at the edge of the solar system, carving out a new civilization in the wilderness. There may not be many volunteer carvers around here, but we like to hear about such things. By that time, I felt we'd got to understand each other, and so I risked teasing him. You mean it's true? Earth is getting decadent. And he looked at me with a grin and answered quickly, oh no, we aren't decadent. Then he paused and added, but the next generation will be. I wonder how far he was joking. Then we talked for 10 minutes about mutual friends like the Helmers and the Wongs and the Morgans and the Lees. Oh, he seems to know everyone important on Titan. And finally he asked about Grandma Ellen, and I told him that she was just the same as ever, which he understood perfectly. And then George came back and took me to his farm. It was the first chance I had of seeing the open countryside in full daylight. I'm still trying to get over it. Chapter 19, Mount Vernon. Don't take this program too seriously, said General George Washington. It's still being changed every day, but your main appointments, I've marked them, aren't going to be altered, especially on July 4th. Duncan leafed through the small brochure that the other had handed to him when they entered President Bernstein's limousine. It was a daunting document, stuffed full of addresses and receptions and balls and processions and concerts. Nobody in the capital was going to get much sleep during the first few days in July, and Duncan felt sorry for poor President Claire Hansen. As a gesture of courtesy in this centennial year, she was president not only of the United States, but also of Earth. And of course, she had not asked for either job. If she had done so, or even if she had been suspected of such a faux pas, she would have been automatically eliminated. For the last century, almost all top political appointments on Terra had been made by random computer selection from the pool of individuals who had the necessary qualifications. It had taken the human race several thousand years to realize that there were some jobs that should never be given to the people who volunteered for them, especially if they showed too much enthusiasm. As one shrewd political commentator had remarked, we want a president who has to be carried screaming and kicking into the White House, but will then do the best job he possibly can so that he'll get time off for good behavior. Duncan put the program away. There would be plenty of opportunity to study it later. Now he had eyes only for his first real look at planet Earth on a bright sunny day. And that was the first problem. Never before in his life had he been exposed to such a glare. Though he had been warned, he was still taken aback by the sheer blazing ferocity of a sun almost 100 times brighter than the star that shone gently on his own world. As the car whispered automatically through the outskirts of Washington, he kept readjusting the transmission of his dark glasses to find a comfortable level. It was appalling to think that there were places on Earth where the sun was even more brilliant than this. And he remembered another warning that had now suddenly become very real. Where the light fell directly on his exposed skin, he could actually feel the heat. On Titan, the very concept of sunburn was ludicrous. Now it was all too easy to imagine, especially for skin as dark as his. He was like a newborn child, seeing the world for the first time. Almost every single object in his field of vision was unfamiliar, or recognizable only from the recordings he had studied. Impressions flowed in upon him at such a rate that he felt utterly confused, until he decided that the only thing to do was to concentrate on a single category of objects and to ignore all the rest, even though they were clamoring for his attention. Trees, for example. There were millions of them. But he had expected that. What he had not anticipated was the enormous variety of their shape, size, and color. And he had no words for any of them. Indeed, as he realized with shame, he could not have identified the few trees in his own Meridian Park. Here was a whole complex universe, part of everyday life for most of mankind since the beginning of history, and he could not utter one meaningful sentence about it, for lack of a vocabulary. When he searched his mind, he could think of only four words that had anything to do with trees: leaf, branch, root, and stem. And all these he had learned in a totally different context. Then there were flowers. At first, Duncan had been puzzled by the random patches of color that he glimpsed from time to time. Flowers were not uncommon on Titan. Usually as highly prized, isolated specimens, though there were some small groups of a few dozen in the park. Here they were as countless as the trees, and even more varied. And once again, he had no names for any of them. This world was full of beauties of which he could not speak. Living on Earth was going to have some unanticipated frustrations. What was that? He suddenly cried. Washington swung around in his seat to get a fix on the tiny object that had just shot across the roadway. A squirrel, I think. Lots of them in these woods. And, of course, they're always getting run over. That's one problem no one has ever been able to solve. He paused, then added gently, I suppose you've never seen one before. Duncan laughed without much humor. I've never seen any animal before, except man. You don't even have a zoo on Titan? No. We've been arguing about it for years, but the problems are too great. And to be perfectly frank, I think most people are scared of something going wrong. Remember the plague of rats in that lunar colony? What we're really frightened of, though, are insects. If anyone ever discovered that a fly had slipped through quarantine, there'd be worldwide hysteria. We've got a nice, sterile environment, and we want to keep it that way. Hmm, said Washington. You're not going to find it easy to adjust to our dirty, infested world. Yet a lot of people here have been complaining for the last century or so that it's too clean and tidy. They're talking nonsense, of course. There's more wilderness now than there has been for 1,000 years. The car had come to the crest of a low hill, and for the first time, Duncan had an extensive view of the surrounding countryside. He could see for at least 20 kilometers, and the effect of all this open space was overwhelming. It was true that he had gazed at much larger and far more dramatic vistas on Titan, but the landscapes of his own world were implacably lethal, and when he traveled on its open surface, he had to be insulated from the hostile environment by all the resources of modern technology. It was almost impossible to believe that there was nowhere here, from horizon to horizon, where he could not stand unprotected in the open, breathing freely in an atmosphere which would not instantly shrivel his lungs. The knowledge did not give him a sense of freedom, but rather of vertigo. It was even worse when he looked up at the sky, so utterly different from the low crimson overcast of Titan. He had flown halfway across the solar system, yet never had he received such an impression of space and distance as he did now, when he stared at the solid-looking white clouds sailing through a blue abyss that seemed to go on forever. It was useless to tell himself that they were only 10 kilometers away, the distance a spaceship could travel in a fraction of a second. Not even the star fields of the Milky Way had yielded such glimpses of infinity. For the very first time, as he looked at the fields and forests spread out around him under the open sky, Duncan realized the immensity of planet Earth by the only measure that counted, the scale of the individual human being. And now he understood that cryptic remark Robert Kleinman had made before he left for Saturn. Space is small. Only the planets are big. If you were here 300 years ago, said his host with considerable satisfaction, about 80% of this would have been houses and highways. Now the figure's down to 10%. And this is one of the most heavily built-up areas on the continent. It's taken a long time, but we finally cleaned up the mess the 20th century left. Most of it, anyway. We've kept some as a reminder. There are a couple of steel towns still intact in Pennsylvania. Visiting them is an educational experience you won't forget, but won't want to repeat. You said this was a 10% built-up area. I find it hard to believe even that. Where is everyone? Duncan queried. Well, there are many more people around than you imagine. I'd hate to think of the mental activity that's going on within 200 meters of us at this very moment. But because this parkway is so well landscaped, you probably haven't noticed the surface exits and feeder roads. Of course, I still have the old-fashioned picture of Terrans as surface dwellers. Oh, we are, essentially. I don't think we'll ever develop the corridor culture you have on the moon and planets. Professor Washington had used that anthropological cliché with some caution. Obviously, he was not quite sure if Duncan approved of it. Nor, for that matter, was Duncan himself. But he had to admit that despite all the debates that had raged about it, the phrase was an accurate description of Titan's social life. One of the chief problems of entertaining off-worlders like yourself, said Washington somewhat ruefully, is that I find myself explaining at great length things that they know perfectly well, but are too polite to admit. A couple of years ago, I took a statistician from Tranquility along this road and gave him a brilliant lecture on the population changes here in the Washington, Virginia region over the last 300 years. I thought he'd be interested, and he was. If I'd done my homework properly, which I usually do, but for some reason had neglected in this case, I'd have found that he'd written the standard work on the subject. After he'd left, he sent me a copy with a very nice inscription. Duncan wondered how much homework George had done on him. Doubtless a good deal. You can assume my total ignorance in these matters. Still, I should have realized that fuser technology would be almost as important on Earth as off it. It's not my field, but you're probably right. When it was cheaper and simpler to melt a home underground than to build it above, and to fit it with view screens that were better than any conceivable windows, it's not surprising that the surface lost many of its attractions. Not all, though. He gestured toward the left-hand side of the parkway. They were approaching a small access road which merged gently into the main traffic lane. It led into a wood about a kilometer away, and through the trees, Duncan could glimpse at least a dozen houses. They were all of different design, yet had common features so that they formed a harmonious group. Every one had steeply gabled red roofs, large windows, gray stone walls, and even chimneys. These were certainly not functional, but many of them served to support complicated structures of metal rods. Fake antique, said Washington with some disapproval. Mid-20th century TV antennas. Oh, well, there's no accounting for tastes. The road was plunging downhill now, and was about to pass under a graceful bridge, carrying a road much wider than the parkway. It was also carrying considerably more traffic, moving at a leisurely 20 or 30 kilometers an hour. Enjoying the good weather, said Washington. You only see a few madmen there in the winter, and you may not believe this, but there was a time when the motorways were the wide roads. They had to be when there was 100 times as much traffic and no automatic steering. He shuddered at the thought. More people were killed on these roads than ever died in warfare. Did you know that? And of course they still get killed up there on the bikeways. No one's ever discovered a way to stop cyclists from wobbling. That's another reason why the road's so wide. As they dived under the bridge, a colorful group of young riders waved down at them, and Washington replied with a cheerful salute. When I was 30 years younger, he said wistfully, a gang of us set off for California on the transcontinental bikeway. No electrocycles allowed either. Well, we were unlucky. Ran into terrible weather in Kansas. Some of us made it, but I wasn't one of them. I've still got a 12-speed diamond special, all carbon, fiber, and beryllium. You can lift it with one finger. Even now, I could do 100 clicks on it if I were fool enough to try. The big car was slowing down, its computer brain sensing an exit ahead. Presently, it peeled off from the parkway, then speeded up again along a narrow road whose surface rapidly disintegrated into a barely visible grass-covered track. Washington took the steering lever just a second before the end auto warning light started to flash on the control panel. "I'm taking you to the farm for several reasons," he said. "Life will soon get hectic for both of us as more visitors start arriving. This may be the last opportunity we have to go through your program in peace and quiet. Also, outworlders can learn a lot about Earth very quickly in a place like this. But to be honest, the truth is that I'm proud of the place and like showing it off." They were now approaching a high stone wall, running for hundreds of meters in both directions. Duncan tried to calculate how much labor it represented if all those oddly shaped blocks were assembled by hand, as surely they must have been. The figure was so incredible that he couldn't believe it. And that huge gate was made of genuine wood, for it was unpainted and he could see the grain. As it swung automatically open, Duncan read the nameplate and turned to the professor in surprise. "But I thought," he began. George Washington looked slightly embarrassed. "That's my private joke," he admitted. "The real Mount Vernon is 50 kilometers southeast of here. You mustn't miss it." That last phrase, Duncan guessed, was going to become all too familiar in the months ahead, right up to the day when he re-embarked for Titan. Inside the walls, the road, now firm-packed gravel, ran in a straight line through a checkerboard of small fields. Some of the fields were plowed, and there was a tractor working in one of them, under direct human control, for a man was sitting on the open driving seat. Duncan felt that he had indeed traveled back in time. "I suppose there's no need to explain," said the professor, "that all this doesn't belong to me. It's owned by the Smithsonian. Some people complain that everything within 100 kilometers of the capital is owned by the Smithsonian, but that's a slight exaggeration. I'm just the administrator. You might say it's a kind of full-time hobby. Every year I have to submit a report, and as long as I do a good job and don't have a fight with the regents, this is my home. Needless to say, I am careful to keep on excellent terms with at least 51% of the regents. By the way, do you recognize any of these crops?" "I'm afraid not, though that's grass, isn't it?" "Well, technically, almost everything here is. Grass includes all the cereals, barley, rice, maize, wheat, oats. We grow them all except rice." "But why? I mean, except for scientific and archaeological interests. Isn't that sufficient?" "But I think you'll find there's more to it than that when you've had a look around." At the risk of being impolite, Duncan persisted. He was not trying to be stubborn, but was genuinely interested. "What about efficiency? Doesn't it take a square kilometer to feed one man with this system?" "Out around Saturn, perhaps. I'm afraid you've dropped a few zeros. If it had to, this little farm could support 50 people in fair comfort, though their diet would be rather monotonous." "I'd no idea. My God, what's that?" "You're joking. You don't recognize it?" "Oh, I know it's a horse, but it's enormous. I can't blame you, though wait until you see an elephant. Charlemagne is probably the largest horse alive today. He's a percheron and weighs over a ton. His ancestors used to carry knights in full armor. Like to meet him?" Duncan wanted to say not really, but it was too late. Washington brought the car to a halt, and the gigantic creature ambled toward them. Until this moment, the limousine had been closed, and they had been traveling in air-conditioned comfort. Now the windows slid down, and primeval earth hit Duncan full in the nostrils. "What's the matter?" asked Washington anxiously. "Are you all right?" Duncan gulped and took a cautious sniff. "I think so," he said without much conviction. "It's just that the air is rather..." He struggled for words as well as breath, and had almost selected ripe when he gratefully switched to rich in the nick of time. "I'm so sorry," apologized Washington, genuinely contrite. "I'd quite forgotten how strange this must be to you. Let me close the window." "Go away, Charlie. Sorry, some other time." The monster, now completely dwarfed the car, and a huge head, half as big as a man, was trying to insert itself through the partially open window on Duncan's side. The air became even thicker, and redolent of more animal secretions than he cared to identify. Two huge, slobbering lips drew back to disclose a perfectly terrifying set of teeth. "Oh, very well," said Professor Washington in a resigned voice. He leaned across his cowering guest, holding out an open palm on which two lumps of sugar had magically appeared. Gently as any maiden's kiss, the lips nuzzled Washington's hand, and the gift vanished as if inhaled. A mild, gentle eye, which from this distance seemed about as large as a fist, looked straight at Duncan, who started to laugh a little hysterically as the apparition withdrew. "What's so funny?" asked Washington. "Look at it from my point of view. I've just met my first monster from outer space. Thank God it was friendly." Chapter 20, The Taste of Honey. I do hope you slept well, said George Washington, as they walked out into the bright summer morning. Quite well, thank you, Duncan answered, stifling a yawn. He only wished that the statement were true. It had been almost as bad as his first night aboard Sirius. Then the noises had all been mechanical. This time they were made by things. Leaving the window open had been a big mistake, but who could have guessed? We don't need air conditioning this time of year, George had explained, which is just as well because we haven't got it. The regents weren't too happy even about electric light in a 400-year-old house. If you do get too cold, here are some extra blankets. Primitive, but very effective. Duncan did not get too cold. The night was pleasantly mild. It was also extremely busy. There had been distant thumpings, which he eventually decided must have been Charlie moving his 1,000 kilos of muscle around the fields. There had been strange squeakings and rustlings, apparently just outside his window, and one high-pitched squeal, suddenly terminated, which could only have been caused by some unfortunate small beast meeting an untimely end. But at last he dozed off, only to be wakened, quite suddenly, by the most horrible of all the sensations that can be experienced by a man in the utter darkness of an unfamiliar bedchamber. Something was moving around the room. It was moving almost silently, yet with amazing speed. There was a kind of whispering rush and occasionally a ghostly squeaking so high-pitched that at first Duncan wondered if he was imagining the entire phenomenon. After some minutes, he decided reluctantly that it was real enough. Whatever the thing might be, it was obviously airborne. But what could possibly move at such speed in total darkness without colliding with the fittings and furniture of the bedroom? While he considered this problem, Duncan did what any sensible man would do. He burrowed under the bedclothes, and presently, to his vast relief, the whispering phantom, with a few more shrill gibberings, swooped out into the night. When his nerves had fully recovered, Duncan hopped out of bed and closed the window, but it seemed hours before his nervous system settled down again. In the bright light of morning, his fears seemed as foolish as they doubtless were, and he decided not to ask George any questions about his nocturnal visitor. Presumably, it was some night bird or large insect. Everyone knew that there were no dangerous animals left on Earth except in well-guarded reservations. Yet the creatures that George now seemed bent on introducing to him looked distinctly menacing. Unlike Charlemagne, they had built-in weapons. I suppose, said George only half-doubtfully, that you recognize these? Of course. I do know some Terran zoology. If it has a leg at each corner and horns, it's not a horse but a cow. I'll only give you half marks. Not all cows have horns. And for that matter, there used to be horned horses. But they became extinct when there were no more virgins to bridle them. Duncan was still trying to decide if this was a joke, and if so, what was the point of it, when he had a slight mishap. Sorry, explained George, I should have warned you to mind your step. Just rub it off on that tuft of grass. Well, at least it doesn't smell quite as bad as it looks, said Duncan resignedly, determined to make the best of a bad job. That's because cows are herbivores. Though they're not very bright, they're sweet, clean animals. No wonder they used to worship them in India. Hello, Daisy. Morning. Ruby? Now, Clemence, that was naughty. It seemed to Duncan that these bovine endearments were rather one-sided, for the recipients gave no detectable reaction. Then his attention was suddenly diverted. Something quite incredible was flying toward them. It was small. Its wingspan could not have been more than 10 centimeters, and it traced wavering zigzag patterns through the air, often seeming about to land on a low bush or patch of grass, then changing its mind at the last moment. Like a living jewel, it blazed with all the colors of the rainbow. Its beauty struck Duncan like a sudden revelation. Yet at the same time, he found himself asking what purpose such exuberant, no arrogant loveliness could possibly serve. What is it, he whispered to his companion, as the creature swept aimlessly back and forth a couple of meters above the grass. Sorry, said George, I can't identify it. I don't think it's indigenous, though I may be wrong. We get a lot of migrants nowadays, and sometimes they escape from collectors. Breeding them's been a popular hobby for years. Then he stopped. He had suddenly understood the real thrust of Duncan's question. There was something close to pity in his eyes when he continued in quite a different tone of voice. I should have explained. It's a butterfly. But Duncan scarcely heard him. That iridescent creature, drifting so effortlessly through the air, made him forget the ferocious gravitational field of which he was now a captive. He started to run toward it with the inevitable result. Luckily, he landed on a clean patch of grass. Half an hour later, feeling quite comfortable but rather foolish, Duncan was sitting in the centuries-old farmhouse with his bandaged ankles stretched out on a footstool while Mrs. Washington and her two young daughters prepared lunch. He had been carried back like a wounded warrior from the battlefield by a couple of tough farm workers who handled his weight with contemptuous ease, and also he could not help noticing radiated a distinct aroma of Charlemagne. It must be strange, he thought, to live in what was virtually a museum, even as a kind of part-time hobby. He would have been continually afraid of damaging some priceless artifact, such as the spinning wheel that Mrs. Washington had demonstrated to him. At the same time, he could appreciate that all this activity made a good deal of sense. There was no other way in which you could really get to understand the past, and there were still many people on Earth who found this an attractive way of life. The 20 or so farm workers, for example, were here permanently, summer and winter. Indeed, he found it rather hard to imagine some of them in any other environment, even after they had been thoroughly scrubbed. But the kitchen was spotless, and a most attractive smell was floating from it. Duncan could recognize very few of its ingredients, but one was unmistakable, even though he had met it today for the first time in his life. It was the mouth-watering fragrance of newly baked bread. It would be all right, he assured his still slightly queasy stomach. He had to ignore the undeniable fact that everything on the table was grown from dirt and dung, and not synthesized from nice, clean chemicals in a spotless factory. This was how the human race had lived for almost the whole of its history. Only in the last few seconds of time had there been any alternative. For one gut-wrenching moment, until Washington had reassured him, he had feared that he might be served real meat. Apparently, it was still available, and there was no actual law against it, though many attempts had been made to pass one. Those who opposed prohibition pointed out that attempts to enforce morality by legislation were always counterproductive. If meat were banned, everybody would want it, even if it made them sick. And anyway, this was a perversion which did harm to nobody. Not so, retorted the prohibitionists. It would do irreparable harm to countless innocent animals and revive the revolting trade of the butcher. The debate continued with no end in sight. Confident that lunch would present mysteries but no terrors, Duncan did his best to enjoy himself. On the whole, he succeeded. He bravely tackled everything set before him, rejecting about a third after one nibble, tolerating another third, and thoroughly appreciating the remainder. As it turned out, there was nothing that he actively disliked, but several items had flavors that were too strange and complicated to appeal to him at first taste. Cheese, for example. That was a complete novelty. There were about six different kinds, and he nibbled at them all. He felt that he could get quite enthusiastic about at least two varieties, if he worked on it. But that might not be a good idea, for it was notoriously difficult to persuade the Titan food chemists to introduce new patterns into their synthesizers. Some products were quite familiar. Potatoes and tomatoes, it seemed, tasted much the same all over the solar system. He had already encountered them as luxury products of the hydroponic farms, but had always found it difficult to get enthusiastic about either, at several solars a kilogram. The main dish was, well, interesting. It was something called steak and kidney pie, and perhaps the unfortunate name turned him off. He knew perfectly well that the contents were based on high-protein soya. Washington had confessed that this was the only item not actually produced on the farm, because the technology needed was too elaborate. Nevertheless, he could not manage more than a few bites. It was too bad that every time he tried to take a mouthful, he kept thinking of the phrase kidney function and its unhappy associations. But the crust of the pie was delicious, and he polished off more than half of it. Dessert was no problem. It consisted of a large variety of fruits, most of them unfamiliar to Duncan even by name. Some were insipid, others very pleasant. But he felt that all were perfectly safe. The strawberries he thought especially good, though he turned down the cream that was offered with them when he discovered by tactful questioning exactly how it was made. He was comfortably replete when Mrs. Washington produced a final surprise, a small wooden box containing a wax honeycomb. As long as he could remember, Duncan had been familiar with that term for lightweight structures. It required a mental volte-face to realize that this was the genuine, original item constructed by Terran insects. We've just started keeping bees, explained the professor. Fascinating creatures, but we're still not sure if they're worth the trouble. I think you'll like this honey. Try it on this crust of new bread. His hosts watched him anxiously as he spread the golden liquid which he thought looked exactly like lubricating oil. He hoped that it would taste better, but he was now prepared for almost anything. There was a long silence, then he took another bite. And another. Well, asked George at last. It's delicious. One of the best things I've ever tasted. I'm so pleased, said Mrs. Washington. George, be sure to send some to the hotel for Mr. Mackenzie. Mr. Mackenzie continued to sample the bread and honey very slowly. There was a remote and abstracted expression on his face, which his delighted hosts attributed to sheer gastronomical pleasure. They could not possibly have guessed at the real reason. Duncan had never been particularly interested in food and had made no effort to try the occasional novelties that were imported into Titan. The few times that any had been pressed upon him, he had not enjoyed them. He still grimaced at the memory of a reputed delicacy called caviar. He was therefore absolutely certain that never before in his life had he tasted honey. Yet he recognized it at once. And that was only half the mystery. Like a name that is on the tip of the tongue, yet eludes all attempts to grasp it, the memory of that earlier encounter lay just below the level of consciousness. It had happened a long time ago, but when and where? For a fleeting moment, he almost took seriously the idea of reincarnation. You, Duncan Mackenzie, were a beekeeper in some earlier life on Earth. Perhaps he was mistaken in thinking that he knew the taste. The association could have been triggered by some random leakage between mental circuits. And anyway, it could not possibly be of the slightest importance. He knew better. Somehow, it was very important indeed. Chapter 21, History Lesson. Of all the old cities, it was generally agreed that Paris and Washington offered the best combination of beauty, culture, history, and convenience. Unlike such largely random aggregations as London and Rome, which had defied millennia of planning, they had been adapted fairly easily to automatic transportation. Could he have risen from his tomb in Arlington, the luckless Pierre Charles L'Enfant would have been proud indeed to have discovered how well he had laid the ground for a technology centuries in his future. Though an official car was available whenever he wished, Duncan preferred to be as independent as possible. Coming from an aggressively egalitarian society, he never felt quite happy when he was afforded special privileges, except, of course, those he had earned himself. Now that his sprained ankle was no longer paining him, he had no excuse for using personal transport, and one could never know a city until one had explored it on foot. Like an ordinary tourist, and Washington expected the incredible total of 5 million before the end of July, Duncan rode the glideways and auto jitneys, gaping at the famous buildings and remembering the great men who had lived and worked here for 50,000 years. In the 5-kilometer-long rectangle from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol, and from the Washington Monument to the White House, no changes had been permitted for more than a century. To ride the shuttle down Constitution Avenue and back along Independence on the south side of the mall was to take a journey through time. And time was the problem, for Duncan could spare only an hour or two a day for sightseeing. His planned schedule had already been wrecked by a factor that he had refused to take seriously, despite numerous warnings. Instead of his usual 6, he needed no fewer than 10 hours of sleep every day. This was yet another side effect of the increased gravity, and there was nothing he could do about it. His body stubbornly insisted on the additional time to overcome the extra wear and tear. Eventually, he knew, he would make a partial adaptation, but he could hardly hope to manage with less than 8 hours. It was maddening to have come all this way, to one of the most fascinating places on Earth, and to be compelled to waste more than 40% of his life in unconsciousness. As with most off-worlders, his first target had been the National Museum of Astronautics on the Mall, because it was here that his own history had begun that day in July 1969. He had walked past the flimsy and improbable hardware of the early space age and had taken his seat with several hundred other visitors in the Apollo Rotunda just before the beginning of the half-hourly show. There was nothing that he had not seen many times before, yet the old drama still gripped him. Here were the faces of the first men to ride these crazy contraptions into space and the sound of their actual voices, sometimes emotionless, sometimes full of excitement, as they spoke to their colleagues on the receding Earth. Now the air shook with the crackling roar of a Saturn launch, magically recreated exactly as it had taken place on that bright Florida morning 307 years ago, and still in many ways the most impressive spectacle ever staged by man. The moon drew closer. Not the busy world that Duncan knew, but the virgin moon of the 20th century. Hard to imagine what it must have meant to the peoples of that time, to whom the Earth was not only the center of the universe, but even to the most sophisticated, still the whole of creation. Now man's first contact with another world was barely minutes ahead. It seemed to Duncan that he was floating in space, only meters away from the spidery lunar module, bristling with antennas and wrapped in multicolored metal foil. The simulation was so perfect that he had an involuntary urge to hold his breath and found himself clutching the handrail, seeking reassurance that he was still on Earth. 2 minutes, 20 seconds, everything looking good. We show altitude about 47,000 feet, said Houston to the waiting world of 1969 and to the centuries to come. And then, cutting across the voice of Mission Control, making a montage of conflicting accents, was a speaker whom for a moment Duncan could not identify, though he knew the voice. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. Even back in 1969, that was already a voice from the grave. The president who had launched Apollo in that speech to Congress had never lived to see the achievement of his dream. We're now in the approach phase, everything looking good, altitude 5,200 feet. And once again, that voice silenced 6 years earlier in Dallas. We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won. And they must be won and used for the progress of all people. Roger, go for landing, 3,000 feet. We're go. Hang tight. We're go. 2,000 feet. 2,000 feet. And why some say the moon? Why choose this as our goal? Why 35 years ago fly the Atlantic? We choose to go to the moon. 200 feet. 4.5 down. 5.5 down. 160. 6.5 down. 5.5 down. 9 forward, 120 feet, 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward, 75 feet, things still looking good. We choose to go to the moon in this decade because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one that we are unwilling to postpone, and one that we intend to win. Forward. Forward 40 feet, down 2.5. Kicking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down, faint shadow, 4 forward. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little. Contact light. Okay, engine stopped. Descent engine command override off. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. The music rose to a crescendo. There before his eyes on the dusty lunar plain, history had lived again. And presently he saw the clumsy, space-suited figure climb down the ladder, cautiously test the alien soil and utter the famous words, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." As always, Duncan listened for that missing A before the word man, and as always, he was unable to detect it. A whole book had been written about that odd slip of the tongue, using as its starting point Neil Armstrong's slightly exasperated, "That's what I intended to say, and that's what I thought I said." All this, of course, was simulation, utterly convincing, and apparently life-sized by the magic of holography, but actually contrived in some studio by patient technicians 2 centuries after the events themselves. There was Eagle, glittering in the fierce sunlight with the stars and stripes frozen motionless beside it, just as it must have appeared early in the lunar morning of that first day. Then the music became quiet, mysterious. Something was about to happen. Even though he knew what to expect, Duncan felt his skin crawling in the ancient involuntary reflex which man had inherited from his hirsute ancestors. The image faded, dissolved into another, similar yet different. In a fraction of a second, 3 centuries had dropped away. They were still on the moon, viewing the Sea of Tranquility from exactly the same vantage point. But the direction of the light had changed, for the sun was now low and the long shadows threw into relief all the myriads of footprints on the trampled ground, and there stood all that was left of Eagle, the slightly peeled and blistered descent stage, standing on its 4 outstretched legs like some abandoned robot. He was seeing Tranquility Base as it was at this instant, or to be precise, 1.25 seconds ago, when the video signals left the moon. Again, the illusion was perfect. Duncan felt that he could walk out into that shining silence and feel the warm metal beneath his hands. Or he could reach down into the dust and lift up the flag to end the old debate that had re-erupted in this centennial year. Should the stars and stripes be left where the blast of the takeoff had thrown it? Or should it be erected again? "Don't tamper with history," said some. "We're only restoring it," said others. Something was happening just beyond the fenced-off area, at the very limits of the 3D scanners. It was shockingly incongruous to see any movement at all at such a spot. Then Duncan remembered that the sea had lost its tranquility at least 2 centuries ago. A bus full of tourists was slowly circling the landing site, its occupants in full view through the curving glass of the observation windows. And though they could not see him, they waved across at the scanners, correctly guessing that someone on Earth was watching at this very moment. The interruption should have destroyed the magic, yet it did not. Nothing could detract from the skill and courage of the pioneers, and they would have been happy to know that where they had first ventured, thousands could now travel in safety and in comfort. That, in the long run, was what history was all about. Chapter 22. Budget. Today I walked at least 3 kilometers and was on my feet for over 2 hours. I'm beginning to feel that life is possible on Earth. But I must be careful not to overdo it, and I'm still using glideways and transporters most of the time. This means that I've not visited the White House or the Capitol, which can only be entered on foot. But I've been to the Museum of Technology and the National Gallery of Art. They have transport cubicles that you can program yourself, so there's no need to waste time on exhibits that don't interest you. Of course, I could stay in the hotel and take a Holovision tour anywhere, but that would be ridiculous. I could do that any time back at home. I must remember that I'll be replaying these words 20, 50, maybe 100 years from now, when this visit to Earth is a dim memory. So it may be a good idea to describe a typical day, if there is such a thing, here at the Centennial Hotel. I wake up at 6:30 and listen to the radio news summary while I'm having my bath. Then I dial the console for any messages that have arrived during the night. Usually there are half a dozen. Not many people know I'm here yet, but I've had quite a few offers of hospitality and have been asked to speak to a number of social and cultural groups. I suspect Ambassador Farrell is behind most of these. Then I set the news abstractor to print out anything that's happened in my area of interest and scan the result. That doesn't take long, since I give Titan as the main heading and we are never in the news. If I want to know what's happening at home, I call the embassy and get the daily dispatch. Usually that makes me rather homesick, especially when my friends and family are being reported, which is most days. At 7:15, I go down to breakfast. As there are only a dozen guests, the place won't get crowded until later in June. I have a table to myself. We nod politely at each other, but no one is very sociable at this time in the morning. The food and service are excellent, and I'm going to miss both when I get home. Terrans know how to live comfortably. They've had enough time to practice, but it was several days before I realized that the hotel was unusual, maybe unique. It's been set up purely for the duration of the festivities, regardless of expense, just for us VIP guests. Staff has been brought from all over the world, some professional, some voluntary, like those academic clowns who met us when we arrived. I still see them from time to time and still can't understand a word they say. Because I'm darker than they are, I think they enjoy making a fool of me. For breakfast, in fact, for all my meals, I try to have something new every day, and this has caused problems. I won't forget my first eggs. I asked for them boiled, because that was the first listing, and the waiter said, "How many minutes, sir?" I don't think I'll ever get used to being called sir by people who are not trying to insult me. Of course, I had no idea what to answer, so I said medium rare, which was a phrase I'd picked up at dinner the night before. The waiter looked at me rather oddly, I thought. He came back 5 minutes later with two eggs sitting in silver cups and placed them in front of me. I just sat there looking at them. Never having seen eggs before, I'd no idea what to do next. And incidentally, they were larger than I'd imagined. I'm afraid I might have gone hungry if another guest a couple of tables away hadn't ordered the same thing. I watched him carefully and discovered that you start by cutting off the top of the shell with a knife. I made a horrible mess of the first egg, but got it right the second time. Later, I found that they'll do this in the kitchen, which saves a lot of trouble. I'll never ask for eggs this way again, but I'm glad I did it once. The taste, though not the texture, was perfectly normal. Our chemists have done a good job here, and I'd never have known that it wasn't synthetic. I've since discovered that very few Terrans have ever tasted a real egg, and there are only two or three farms that still produce them. Hens are not very interesting animals, it appears. I should have mentioned the menu. It's a most elaborate affair, beautifully printed, and changes every day. I'm keeping a set as a souvenir, though I don't recognize half the items or understand many of the instructions. I suspect that some are jokes. What does no tipping mean? And gentlemen are requested to use the cuspidors provided. What is a cuspidor? And why only gentlemen and not ladies? I must ask George. After breakfast, I go back to my room and deal with the overnight messages. Usually I spend the next 2 or 3 hours at the console talking to people, recording data, transferring items from the main memory to my Minisec, or vice versa. Most of this is dull, but important. I'm working through a list of contacts that every head of department on Titan has given me. I'm trying to be as tactful as possible, but I'm afraid I'm not going to be very popular by the time I've delivered all these complaints and apologies. And I've run into something that complicates business on Earth to an incredible extent. I knew about it, but hadn't realized its full implications. It's the problem of time zones. There are some advantages in belonging to a corridor culture. We're not slaves of the sun and can set all our clocks to the same time, all over Titan, but on Earth. There are 4 time zones, America, Africa, Asia, Oceania, 6 hours apart. So when you want to speak to anyone or make an appointment, you have to know what zone he's in. And when you move from one zone to another, you have to put your watch ahead or back 6 hours. It's very awkward and confusing, but it was even worse a couple of centuries ago. Then there were 24 zones, one for every hour of the day. The development of global telecommunications made that situation impossible. Not that it's very satisfactory even now. There's talk of going over to a single world time, probably absolute ephemeris time, and ignoring the day-night cycle just as we do. But the arguments on both sides are nicely balanced, and no one expects a decision in a hurry. After all, it took several hundred years to get the world calendar adopted, and that was because the Martian and lunar administrations simply wouldn't put up with Earth's ridiculous months any longer. Where was I? Oh, the morning's business. By noon, I usually feel that I need a break, and I spend half an hour in the swimming pool. At first, I did this merely to get away from gravity, but now I enjoy it for its own sake. I've even learned to swim and feel quite confident in the water. When I get home, I'll be a regular visitor to the Oasis pool. After that, I go for a quick walk in the hotel grounds. There are more flowers and trees here than I ever imagined, all beautifully kept. It reminds me a little of George's farm, though on a smaller scale. But Earth is a dangerous place, and there are things I'd not been warned about. Who would have guessed that there were plants with thorns on them, sharp enough to draw blood? I'm going to make very sure they never take me to any really wild places on this complicated old planet. And even here in Washington, not everything is under control. Yesterday, just as I was going for a walk, it started to rain. Rain? In no time, the streets were wet and glistening. They looked so slippery, I should have been afraid to walk on them. But from my window, I could see people moving about as if nothing had happened. Some of them weren't even wearing protective clothing. After watching for a while, I went down to the lobby and stood under the portico. I had to fight off the bellboys. They tried to get me a car and couldn't believe I merely wanted to watch the falling water from a safe place. Eventually, I managed to make myself believe that it wasn't liquid ammonia and stepped outside for a few seconds, all in the cause of science. Needless to say, I got wet very quickly, and I can't say I really enjoyed it. Around 1300, I go to lunch, usually with someone who wants to talk business or politics, or both. There are some wonderful restaurants here, and the great problem is not to eat too much. I've put on a couple of kilos since I arrived. One of the favorite dining places, I've been there several times, is called the Sans Souci, which means without a care, in Greek or Latin, I'm not sure which. Apparently, President Washington himself used to eat there, though I find that hard to believe. One would have thought they'd have had photographs to prove it. Stupid, I keep forgetting. I met my first congressman in the Sans Souci, Representative Matsukawa of Hawaii, Senator Gromyko of Alaska. It was a purely social get-together. We had no business to discuss. But they were interested in Titan because they both felt that it had some points in common with their states, now temporarily back in the Union. They're quite right. Engineer Warren McKenzie made the same point aboard Sirius. To the people who explored the Pacific in canoes, the ocean must have seemed about as large as the solar system, and the development of Alaska in its time must have been as tough a job as getting a foothold on Titan. After lunch, I do a little sightseeing, then get back to the hotel and carry on with the day's business until dinner time. By then, I'm too exhausted to think of anything but bed. The very latest I've been awake is 21:30. It's going to be quite embarrassing if I don't adapt soon to the local lifestyle. Already, I've had to turn down several party invitations because I couldn't afford to miss the sleep. That sort of thing isn't easy to explain, and I hope I've not offended any of the hostesses this city's famous for. I have accepted one late engagement, because George stressed its importance. This to speak in person, not holovision, to a group called the Daughters of the Revolutions. They're mostly elderly ladies, queen dragons, but dears when you get to know them, George said. And they're all over the place this centennial year. Originally, they were only concerned with the American Revolution, but later they became less exclusive. I'm told I'll meet direct descendants of Lenin and Mao and Bulunga. What a pity Washington never had any children. I wonder why. Because I've given priority to my official mission, I'm still working on that damn speech. I've had almost no time for personal or family business. About the only thing I've been able to do in this direction is to contact the bank and establish my credentials so that I can use Malcolm's accumulated funds. Even if everything works out according to plan and our estimates are correct, the budget will be tight. My big fear is running out of money and having to go to finance for more of our precious Terran Solars. If that happens, the family will be under attack from all quarters and it won't be easy to think of a good defense. This is one reason why I've done no shopping, that and the time factor. I won't know how much money I'll have until I'm almost ready to leave. But I have run some of the catalogs through the console and they're fascinating. You could spend a lifetime, and 1 million Solars a day, sampling the luxuries of Earth. Every conceivable artifact has its tape stored somewhere, waiting to go into a replicator. Since manufacturing costs are essentially zero, I don't understand why some items are so expensive. The capital costs of the replicators must have been written off decades ago. One would have thought. Despite Colin's efforts, I don't really understand Terran economy. But I'm learning many things fast. For example, there are some smart operators around on the lookout for innocents from space. Yesterday, I was going through a display of Persian carpets. Antique, not replicated. wondering if I could possibly afford to take a small one back to Marissa. I can't. This morning there was a message, addressed to me personally, correct room number, from a dealer in Tehran, offering his wares at very special rates. He's probably quite legitimate and may have some bargains, but how did he know? I thought console circuits were totally private. But perhaps this doesn't apply to some commercial services. Anyway, I didn't answer. Nor have I acknowledged some even more personal messages from various sex clubs. They were very explicit, and I've stored them as mementos for my old age. After the carpet episode, I was wondering if any would be tailored to my psych profile, which must be on record somewhere. That would have made me mad. But it was very broadband stuff, and the artwork was beautiful. Perhaps when I'm not so busy. Duncan stopped talking. He was not quite sure why. And then he began to laugh at his hesitation. Could it be that, despite fairly heroic efforts, the Mackenzies were puritanical after all? For he had just recalled that only a kilometer or so from this very spot, a president of the United States had got into perfectly terrible trouble with a tape recorder. But whether it had been a Roosevelt or a Kennedy, he was not quite sure. Chapter 23, Daughters of the Revolutions. George Washington had been right. They did look like dragons. Formidable, tight-lipped ladies, few of them were under 70, and they sported the most astonishing array of hats, in more shapes and sizes than Duncan would have believed possible. On Titan, hats were as rare as wigs, and even less useful. Not that there was any question of utility with most of this headgear. It was obviously designed to impress or intimidate. It certainly intimidated Duncan. So did the introductions, though he quickly lost track of all the names being thrown at him. Every one of these ladies, it appeared, boasted ancestors who had played some role in the great revolutions that had shaped the modern world. As he shook hands and listened to the chairperson's brief comments, he felt that he was being presented with snapshots of history. Most of the audience, of course, traced its involvement back to the birth of the United States, and he had heard vaguely of such places as Yorktown and Valley Forge. But he could only smile with feigned comprehension when hearing of revered ancestors who had fought in the hills with Castro, or accompanied Mao on the Long March, or shared the sealed train with Lenin, or fallen in the final assault on Cape Town. At last, all the introductions, including his own, were completed. Feeling none too sure of himself, Duncan perched on the high chair overlooking his expectant audience. "Perhaps I should apologize," he began, "for addressing you from a seated position. But as you know, I've spent all my life on a world with only a fraction of Earth's gravity. Believe me, having five times normal weight isn't exactly enjoyable. How would you like it if you woke up one morning and found your scales registered 350 kilograms? There was a moment of shocked surprise as the audience confronted the startling vision. Then a titter ran around the room. "Fine," Duncan told himself, "I've broken the ice." Then he realized that there was an undertone of something besides good-natured amusement in the sound, as if his listeners were laughing not with him, but at him. He glanced frantically around the audience, then to his horror, saw that there was a perfectly enormous woman halfway back on the far left. She was the fattest person Duncan had ever seen, and the entire audience seemed to be carefully not looking in her direction. "Well," thought Duncan, "I've got nothing more to lose. It can only go uphill from here." He plunged into his prepared speech. "The history of my world goes back little more than halfway to the event we are all celebrating next month. The first manned ship touched down on Titan in 2015. But the first permanent base wasn't established there until considerably later, 2046. Even then, it was only a scientific observation post, with the crews rotating back to Earth every few years. There was no thought in those days of a self-contained colony that might eventually develop its own culture, just as happened on this continent. In any case, the 21st century was too busy dealing with Mars and the Moon to have the energy or the resources for activities farther afield." Could that have been a yawn he spotted there near the back of the hall? Surely not so soon. He was being morbidly sensitive. That sea of hats was getting him down. Most of the faces beneath them seemed to be reasonably attentive. But how to make these sleek and elegant matrons, not one of whom probably had ever been farther than the Moon, understand the harsh realities of his distant world? It was a challenge, and that was something that no Mackenzie could ever resist. "You may wonder why anyone would want to settle down in a place where the temperature never rises above 100 below zero, where the atmosphere is poisoned by methane and ammonia, and the sun's so feeble that you can't detect its heat when it shines full on your face. Well, I won't pretend that Titan is an attractive tourist resort, though we have some tourists, believe it or not. But it does have certain unique advantages, which is why it's become important in human affairs. First of all, it's the only place outside the Earth where a man can move around on the surface without a full spacesuit. That may surprise you after what I've just said about the conditions there. I don't deny that we need protection, but it's much less than required on the Moon or even on Mars. The atmosphere is so dense, It allows us to breathe with simple oxygen masks, though we have to be extremely careful to avoid any leaks. If you've ever smelled ammonia, you'll know why. And lightweight thermosuits can cope with the temperature, except in very bad weather. Having an atmosphere, even a poisonous one, makes life easier in dozens of ways. It means that we can use aircraft for long-distance transportation. It protects us from meteorites, not that there are many out there, and from the temperature extremes that a completely airless world would have. And most important of all, we've got an atmosphere we can burn and use as a source of energy. It's just the opposite of the way things are on Earth. Here you burn hydrogen compounds, and the atmosphere supplies the oxygen. On Titan, we have to provide the oxygen, and we burn that in the hydrogen atmosphere. But the final result is the same: heat and energy to warm ourselves and drive our vehicles. That hydrogen-rich atmosphere is Titan's greatest asset, and the reason men settled there in the first place. For without hydrogen, our spaceships cannot operate. Our chemical rockets burn it, and our fusion rockets fuse it. Hydrogen is the key to the solar system. And there are only two places where it's easily obtainable. One is right here, in the oceans of Earth. But it's expensive, lifting it out into space against the huge gravity field of your world, the one that's keeping me pinned to this chair right now. Duncan paused hopefully and got a few encouraging smiles. The other place is Titan. It's a filling station, if you like, halfway to the stars. And because of its low gravity, we can export hydrogen cheaply to anywhere in the solar system using robot tankers carrying up to 10,000 tons. Without us, space travel would be at least four times as expensive as it is now, and interplanetary commerce would be crippled. And how we get that hydrogen is interesting. We've been called sky miners because of the way we take it out of the atmosphere. Specialized aircraft, ram scoops, fly at high altitude and ever-increasing velocity, collecting hydrogen and liquefying it, then jumping up to orbit when they have a full load. There they rendezvous with the space tankers, deliver the goods, and go back into the atmosphere for more. They stay up for weeks on end, and land only when it's time for servicing or a change of crew. Better not overdo the technicalities, Duncan told himself. It was a pity, but he'd be wise to omit the most dramatic part of the whole operation: the fall down to Saturn after the robot tanker had escaped from Titan, and the hairpin loop around the giant planet taking advantage of its gravitational field to launch the precious payload to the customer who was waiting 1 or 2 years in the future. And he certainly couldn't do justice to the most spectacular trip in the solar system, the Saturn sleigh ride, as it had been aptly christened by one of the few men who had raced across the thousands of kilometers of spinning ice that formed the rings. Duncan bravely resisted these temptations. He had best stick to history and politics, even though in this case, both were largely byproducts of technology. One could make a very interesting comparison, he continued, between the settlement of Titan and the opening up of this continent 300 or 400 years earlier. I'm sure it took the same kind of pioneering spirit, and in our case, we're lucky because we have films and tapes and cassettes of the whole period. More than that, some of our pioneers are still around, ready to reminisce at the drop of a hat. In fact, quicker than that, because hats drop slowly on Titan. That was rather neat, Duncan told himself, though it was undoubtedly inspired by the view in front of him. Why did they wear the damn things indoors? Obviously, they were trying to outdo each other. Most of these creations were not merely useless. They looked as if they would take off in the slightest wind. A flicker of movement caught Duncan's eye. I don't believe it, he thought. Then he stole another quick glance, hoping his interest would be unobserved. Either he had taken leave of his senses, which was an acceptable working hypothesis, or there was a live fish swimming around in the third row. It was orbiting in a tiny crystal globe, surrounded by a tasteful display of corals and seashells, on the head of an intense middle-aged lady who, unluckily, was staring straight at him with pop-eyed concentration. Duncan gulped, gave a sickly smile, and stumbled on. He tried to push to the back of his mind the baffling problem of the fish's life support system. If he stopped to worry about that, he would be tripping over his tongue in no time at all. Where was he? Oh, back with the pioneers, difficult though it was to focus on them in this lavishly decorated and slightly overheated room. I'm sure many of you have read Professor Prescott's famous book With Axe and Laser, A Study of Two Frontiers. Though he draws his parallels between America and Mercury, everything that he says is also applicable to Titan. As I recall, Prescott argues that man's conquest of the wilderness on this planet was based on three things: the axe, the plow, and fire. He uses these symbolically rather than literally. The axe stands for all tools, the plow for agriculture, and fire for all forms of power generation. The axe cut down the forests, shaped homes and furniture. More refined tools manufactured all the other necessities of civilized living, from cups and saucers to aircraft and computers. The axe wasn't much use on the moon or Mercury or Titan. What took its place was the power laser. That was the tool that carved out our homes and later cities, and it opened up the mineral resources buried kilometers down in the rocks. Of course, we were luckier than the old pioneers because we did not have to spend endless man-hours making every single object that we needed. All the artifacts of civilization were already stored in the memories of our replicators. As long as we fed in the raw materials, anything we needed, no matter how complex, would be produced automatically in a matter of seconds, and in any quantity we needed. I know we take the replicator for granted, but it would have seemed like magic to our ancestors. As for the plow, that too had no place on our world, but by the 22nd century, it had no place on yours either. We simply took your food technology to the planets. And on Titan, it was easy, much easier than anywhere else in the solar system. We have enormous deposits of hydrocarbons, waxes, oils, and so forth. Who knows, perhaps one day we may be feeding Earth. Finally, the third item, fire. Occasionally, we still use it, though as I explained, we have to provide the oxygen. But again, as on Earth, we get all the power we need from nuclear fusion. We're already heating large areas of Titan and are thinking about major changes to its climate. But as some of these may be irreversible, we're proceeding very cautiously. We don't want to repeat the mistakes that have been made elsewhere. Duncan nearly set on Earth, but tactfully changed gear just in time. He did a swift scan of the audience, carefully avoiding the fish in the third row. The ladies still seemed to be with him, though one or two hats were nodding suspiciously. Yet despite their sophisticated tools, the first generation of our pioneers probably had as tough a time as your Pilgrim fathers. What they lacked in hostile Indians was more than made up for by a hostile environment. Deaths by accidents were common. Anyone who was careless did not live long on Titan in the early days. But slowly and painfully, we managed to convert our first primitive bases, which had no more than the bare necessities for survival, into fairly comfortable towns, then cities, like Meridian, Carbonville, Oasis. True, the largest has a population of only 50,000. There are still fewer than a quarter of a million of us on Titan. But as we all know, quality is more important than quantity. There were a few smiles at this strikingly original remark, and Duncan felt encouraged to continue. But then he saw something that almost stopped him dead in his tracks. The smallest member of his audience was showing obvious signs of distress. Back there in the third row, that infernal fish was swimming around and round at an acute angle to the rest of the world. Since Duncan had noticed no alteration in the force of gravity, he could only assume that something had happened to its sense of balance. Even as he watched, it flipped over on its side. Very close at hand, somebody was talking, using Duncan's voice. Whether the words made any sense, he could not even guess. He was elsewhere, struggling with a problem of life and death. Should he stop talking and warn Miss Fishbowl of the impending tragedy of which she was obviously unaware? Perhaps there was still time for her to rush to the nearest animal hospital. That creature might be the last of its species, the only one in the world doomed to extinction owing to his negligence. Alas, it was too late. With a final convulsive wriggle, the fish turned belly up and floated motionless in its crystal globe. Duncan had never received a more obvious hint. As quickly as possible, he brought his peroration to a close. To his astonishment, the applause seemed perfectly genuine. He hoped he was not mistaken, but in any event, he was quite sure of one thing. After this ordeal, speaking to the Congress of the United States would be child's play. Chapter 24, Kalindi. The package had been delivered to Duncan's room while he was lecturing. It was a small, neatly wrapped cylinder, about 15 centimeters high and 10 across, and he could not imagine what it contained. He hefted it in his hand a few times. It was fairly heavy, but not heavy enough to be metal. When he tapped it, there was merely a dull, unreverberant thud. He abandoned futile speculation and tore open the envelope taped around the cylinder. Mount Vernon Farm. Dear Duncan. Sorry about the delay, but we had a little accident. Charlemagne managed to walk into the hives one night. Luckily, or not, depending upon the point of view, our bees don't sting. However, production was badly affected. Remembering your reaction last time, Clara and I thought you might like this souvenir of your visit. Best, George. How kind of them, Duncan told himself. When he got through the wrappings, he found a transparent plastic jar full of golden liquid. The locking mechanism on the screw-top lid baffled him for a moment. It had to be pushed down and tightened before it could be opened. But after a few frustrating minutes, he had it off. The smell was delicious, and once again there was that haunting sense of familiarity. Like a small boy, he could not resist dipping in a finger, then savoring the tip with his tongue. Some delayed action circuit was operating. Deep in the recesses of memory, the most primitive and potent of all senses was opening doors that had been locked for years. His body remembered before his mind. As he relaxed, contentedly, in a warm glow of sheer animal lust, everything came back to him. Honey tasted like Kalindi. Sooner or later, of course, he would have contacted her. But he wanted time to adjust, and to feel as much at home on Earth as he could ever be. So he had told himself, but that was not the only reason. The logical part of his mind had no wish for him to be sucked back into the whirlpool that had engulfed him as a boy. But in matters of the heart, logic was always defeated. In the long run, it could do no more than say, "I told you so," and by then it was too late. He had known Kalindi's body, but he had been too young to know her love. Now he was a man, and there was nothing that Carl could do to stop him. The first task was to locate Kalindi. He felt some disappointment that she had not already contacted him, for the news of his arrival had been well publicized. Was she indifferent, even embarrassed? He would take that chance. Duncan walked to the console, and the screen became alive as his fingers brushed the on pad. Now it was a miracle beyond the dreams of any poet, a charmed magic casement opening on all seas, all lands. Through this window could flow everything that man had ever learned about his universe, and every work of art he had saved from the dominion of time. All the libraries and museums that had ever existed could be funneled through this screen, and the millions like it scattered over the face of Earth. Even the least sensitive of men could be overwhelmed by the thought that one could operate a console for 1,000 lifetimes and barely sample the knowledge stored within the memory banks that lay triplicated in their widely separated caverns, more securely guarded than any gold. There was an appropriate irony in the fact that two of these buried complexes had once been control centers for nuclear missiles. But now Duncan was not concerned with the heritage of mankind. He had a more modest objective in view. His fingers tapped out the word info, and the screen instantly displayed, "Please specify category. 01, general. 02, science. 03, history. 04, art. 05, recreation. 06, geography. 07, earth directory. 08, moon directory. 09, planet directory." And so on for more than 30 subject headings. As his fingers tapped out 07, earth directory, Duncan could not help recalling his very first confrontation with the Terran Comsol system. The categories were almost the same as on Titan, but activate was on the left-hand side of the keyboard, and the unfamiliar position had made him forget to press it. So nothing had happened for a good 5 seconds. Then a really beautiful girl had appeared on the screen and said sweetly, in a voice to which Duncan could have listened forever, "You seem to be having some difficulty. Have you remembered to press activate?" He had stared at her until she faded out, leaving a dazzling smile that, like the Cheshire Cat, lingered in his memory. Though he had promptly repeated the same mistake 5 times in a row, she never came back. It was a different girl each time. Oh, well, he told himself. They had probably all been dead for years. When Earth Directory came up, he was requested to give family name, given names, personal number, and last known address. Region, country, province, postal code. But that was the problem. He had not heard from Kalindi for 5 years, and he had never known her personal number. It had even been hard to recall her family name. If it had been Smith or Wong or Lee, the task would have been hopeless. He typed out Ellerman, Catherine Linden, and a string of don't knows. The console shot back. "What information do you want?" Duncan answered. "Address and VIDI number. Activate." Suppose Kalindi had changed her name. Unlikely. She was not the sort of woman who would let herself be dominated by any man, even if she established a long-term relationship with one. Duncan could imagine the man changing his name rather than the other way around. He had barely completed this thought when, to his surprise, the screen announced, "Ellerman Catherine Linden. North Atlant. New York, New York. Personal. 373-496-000-000. VIDI. 99-373-496-000-000. The speed with which the system had located Kalindi was so amazing that it was several seconds before two even more surprising facts registered in Duncan's mind. The fact was that Kalindi had managed to secure a quite literally one-in-a-million personal identification. The second was that she had been able to get it incorporated in her VIDI number. Duncan would not have believed it possible. Carl had once tried to do the same thing, and even he had failed. Kalindi's powers of persuasion had always been remarkable, but he realized that he had underestimated them. So here she was, not only on this planet, but on this continent, a mere 500 kilometers away. He had only to tap out that number, and he could look once more into the eyes that had so often smiled at him from the bubble stereo. He knew that he was going to do it. Of that there was never any question. Yet still he hesitated, partly savoring the moment of anticipation, partly wondering just what he was going to say. He'd still not decided this when, almost impulsively, he tapped out the 14 digits that opened up the road to the past. Duncan would never have recognized her had they met in the street. He had forgotten what years of Earth gravity could do. For long seconds, he stared at the image, unable to speak. Finally, she broke the silence with a slightly impatient, "Yes, what is it?" Before he could answer, Duncan found it necessary to start breathing again. "Kalindi," he said, "don't you remember me?" The expression in those lustrous eyes changed imperceptibly. Then there was the trace of a smile, though a wary one. "Be reasonable," Duncan told himself. "She can't possibly recognize you after 15 years. How many thousands of people has she met in that time in this busy, crowded world? And how many lovers since Carl?" But she surprised him, as usual. "Of course, Duncan. How lovely to see you. I knew you were on Earth, and had been wondering when you'd call." He felt a little embarrassed, as perhaps he was intended to do. "I'm sorry," he said. "I was incredibly busy. The centennial celebrations, you know." As he stared into the screen, the remembered features slowly emerged from the stranger looking back at him. The impact of the years was not as great as he had supposed. Much of the unfamiliarity was purely artificial. She had changed the color of her hair so that it was no longer black, but brown, shot with flecks of gold. The oval of the face was the same, the ivory skin still flawless. When he forgot that image in the bubble stereo, he could see that she was still Kalindi, more mature and even more desirable. He could also see that she was sitting in a crowded office with shadowy figures coming and going all around her, and occasionally handing her sheafs of documents. Somehow, he had never imagined Kalindi as a busy executive, but he was quite sure that if she had set her heart on the role, she would be a great success. It was obvious, however, that this was no time for tender endearments. The best that he could hope for was to arrange a meeting as soon as possible. He had come all the way from Saturn. It should not be difficult to span the extra distance between Washington and New York, but it seemed there were problems. He even got the impression that there was some hesitation, even reluctance, on Kalindi's part. She consulted a very complicated diary, threw several dates at him, and appeared slightly relieved when Duncan found that they clashed with his own appointments. He was becoming quite disheartened when she suddenly explained, "Wait a minute. Are you free next Thursday and Friday?" "I think so. Yes, I can manage." It was almost a week ahead. He would have to be patient. But 2 days, that sounded promising. "Wonderful." A slow, mischievous smile spread over her face, and for a moment the old Kalindi looked back at him. "And it's perfect, so very appropriate. I couldn't have arranged it better if I'd tried." "Arranged what?" asked Duncan. "Contact the Van Hyatts at this number. They're just outside Washington, and do exactly what they tell you. Say that Enigmas asked them to bring you along as my personal guest. They're nice people, and you'll like them. Now, I really must break off. See you next week." She paused for a moment, then said carefully, "I'd better warn you that I'll be so busy, we won't have much time even then. But I promise you, you'll really enjoy the experience." Duncan looked at her doubtfully. Notwithstanding that assurance, he felt disappointed. He also hated to be involved in something over which he had no control. Mackenzie's organized other people, for their own good, of course, even if the victim did not always agree. This reversal of standard procedure made him uncomfortable. "I'll come," he said, taking the plunge. "But at least tell me what this is all about." Kalindi gave that stubborn little moo which he remembered so well. "No," she replied firmly. "I'd be violating the motto of my own organization, and even the executive vice president can't do that." "What organization?" "Really?" she said with a smile of pure delight. "I thought Enigma was rather well known, but this makes it even better."